So this is the breakout session where we're going to talk about Unity, basically the last lessons learned from over the last 6 years. Unity stands for Urban Networks to Increase Thriving Youth. It's a program funded. It's an initiative funded by the Centers for Disease Control through a cooperative agreement to Prevention Institute, and also it's also supported by the Kresge Foundation and the California Wellness Foundation. And joining me up here, and I'll introduce them all in more detail before each of them gets up, is Howard Spivak with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And I have his official title in the bio that I'm going to use to introduce him. I don't have it right now. Sorry, Howard, I don't have it memorized.
It's, neither do I.
And then we also have Kirsten Stewart from Futures Without Violence and Dr. Karen Butler from the City of Cleveland Department of Public Health. She's the Public Health Director for the City of Cleveland. I don't have any presenter disclosures, and before each of us talks, we have to just say whether we have something to disclose or not, financial interest. So I want to talk about Unity, but before I launch into what Unity is, and I'm going to do that in a little bit more detail, I want to start with sort of the lessons that we've learned over the last 6 years. And also, as I go through these lessons in a second, each of the speakers will be speaking to one of the lessons or multiple lessons that they've their topics touch on. So the first lesson that we found was that over the last 6 years, public health has not seen and infrequently sees itself as a solution to preventing violence. Preventing violence is not about a particular program, one particular program. A lot of times people come up and say, what's the program? What do we need to do? It's about strategies. The next lesson is that we know how to prevent violence. We've seen it on the ground, and we have some examples of things that work. We also know that cities need help to advance a public health approach to prevent violence, and we'll go into details about that later. There's little political will for a public health approach to prevent violence, and we'll talk about why that is, some of the research that was done through Unity. And also, we know that violence relates to other issues, and we'll talk about those interrelationships. So this is sort of like the overarching where we're headed this morning. So when we think about violence, the image that comes to my mind is West Oakland. We did a site visit there about almost a year ago. And the thing that hit me the most was at the end of our site visit, the high school youth did a photo voice. They presented the results of their photo voice project. Do you all know what photo voice is? Basically, kids go out, they take pictures, and they come back and they tell you, what they liked, what could be better, issues and opportunities are. And as each of the youth, there were four or five of them that presented, as each of them started talking about all of the different things that were going on that they were proud of, it just seemed like these were, figuratively, there was a rose in the middle of a sidewalk that was completely broken. And so the things that they were extremely proud of are things that in many other neighborhoods we see, we take for granted. But the thing that really hit me, there were two things that really hit me. One of them was a young lady who at the end of her presentation said, people just don't care about, lower class people. She used those terms, lower class people like us. People just don't care. And there was a big sense of hopelessness there. Although, through their project as it progressed, they started to learn that they do have agency and they can make a difference. And being part of this project was sort of like the first step. The second thing that really affected me that day was walking out. I think we got done at 6 o'clock, and because of daylight savings time or whatever, it was already dark outside. And we get to the front door, and there's police crime tape all spread for, they wouldn't let us out. And the reason they wouldn't let us out is because there had been a shooting less than a half a block away, a shooting where someone had been killed. It wasn't a youth from the high school. It was just something that happened there on the ground at a liquor store. And the part that amazed me about this was that the administrators that were shepherding us around, they wouldn't let us leave. they told all of us that were visiting, all you guys just need to make yourself comfortable. We have to wait until this is all cleaned up, till the police let us out, because we're going to drive you back to your cars that were parked six blocks away. But the kids, the youth that were there, they said, okay, and they mentioned them all by name, and the counselor knew them all and said, okay, do you guys know how to get home? And all the kids in unison just said, yeah. And so the youth, the kids, the high school children were released, and they were allowed to go home, whereas all of us, they had to just keep us indoors until it cleared, until they felt that it was good for us to leave. And so that kind of... It kind of got at my core, because, you know, what is it that these youth have to go through on a daily basis as they navigate these communities, as they navigate these neighborhoods? And I think one of our colleagues says it best. His name is Howard Pinder. He's a professor at UC San Francisco. He says, you know, we talk a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder in a lot of these communities, a lot of our communities. He calls it persistent stress disorder. And these youth... One of them described that as they leave their community, they can feel their sense of ease increase because they don't have to be on point. They don't have to, you know, be on guard because, you know, violence, they've been trained that violence can come from anywhere. But as they leave the neighborhood to go visit cousins in another part of town or another city, they can feel their ease just start to decrease. Whereas when they're coming back to their community, they can feel it increase again, and they get back on point. So, you know, we're asking children that are growing up and families that are living in these kinds of communities to, you know, do better with what they've got, to just say no, to, you know, take back the night. We're telling them to do a lot of things that they really don't have control over themselves. And so unity is one way that we're trying to create multi-sectoral public health approaches to improve the environment so people don't have to live like that. So on the one hand, we have the people that are growing up in these areas, and then the second, we have the media portrayal of these youth. So all of a sudden now we're shifting to, you know, these are youth that are growing up on guard, on point, who inside their own heads, they don't expect to live past the age of 20. And now, in the media, we've got this portrayal of them where they are wild in the streets. They're committing all of these, crimes or this violence against one another. It's just a problem that we can't control. And we'll talk a little bit more about these perceptions in a while. But sort of this is sort of like the frame when we start, you know, when we talk about unity, when we talk about violence prevention, this is the picture that many of us have in our heads. So unity builds support for effective, scalable, sustainable efforts to prevent violence before it occurs so that urban youth can thrive in safe environments with ample opportunities and supportive relationships. Basically, we're looking for opportunities that exist in other communities that are absent in these communities for whatever reason. The lead partners of Unity are the Prevention Institute, Harvard School of Public Health, UCLA School of Public Health, UC San Francisco, and it's supported by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the California Wellness Foundation, and the Kresge Foundation. And Unity has a national consortium of over 300 members from cities, national and state organizations, and community-based organizations. The Unity City Network has it's a growing number of cities committed to advancing prevention activities and preventative approaches. And two weeks ago, we had our most recent meeting. We had over 18 cities represented, and I have a map later on that I'll show you of the city network. And our Unity co-chairs are Larry Cohen, who's up here in front, from Prevention Institute, Deborah Protostiff from the Harvard School of Public Health, and Billy Weiss from the UCLA School of Public Health. And our steering committee is pretty illustrious, and the font's small, but this is up here just to show you the level of organizations that we have partnering with us: Chicago Police, Chicago Ceasefire, Cleveland Mayor's Office, American Academy of Pediatrics, and one addition that's not up here, Isaiah Thomas just joined our steering committee. He's someone who, Isaiah Thomas, the basketball player, he's someone who's been out and kind of working on his own, one-on-one, trying to get youth to rethink the futures of their lives. And he's been doing, there's articles on his work from 1985. that if this isn't the flavor of the day for him. The Unity activities, we coordinate the Unity City Network that connects cities with each other, because as we have learned, as we make the case, what we find is that each city is approaching this just a little bit differently, and each of them has, they've sort of become the experts in their area, and by bringing the cities together, there's a cross-pollinization that occurs. And again, we had our meeting a couple of weeks ago, and we just saw this in action. It was very inspiring. We also guide effective and sustainable practice by providing training, tools, and consultations. We also make the case. We try to frame the discourse on preventing violence. And the way we do that is we take the great examples that the Karen Butlers in Cleveland or the Felicia Davises in Chicago or, you know, other partners, the Mayor Rybacks in Minneapolis, we take their examples and we write them up so that others can use them. Because this struggle between a public health approach and a law enforcement approach to preventing violence, it's a very strong struggle. And it seems that it's an uphill battle for public health sometimes, like today. We also educate decision makers and inform national strategies, again, highlighting what works and also supportive policies and resources. And here's a recent map of our Unity City Network. What's not up here is Portland, Oregon, Salinas, California. Detroit, Michigan went from yellow to red. Red means that we've got a formal MOU with the city. Yellow means that we are working with them closely, but we just haven't formalized the partnership yet. And for Unity, one of our lessons that we've learned is that you need leadership from the top to help make this happen. So that's why we seek buy-in from the mayor's offices, from public health directors, but we seek buy-in at the highest levels. So one of the first things that we did is we did an assessment. So what's the lay of the land, you know, when it comes to a public health approach to preventing violence? So we had telephone interviews with key informants in 15 of the 45 largest U.S. cities. We talked to mayors, police chiefs, public health directors, and school superintendents. And this is what we found. Youth violence is a serious issue for cities. Responses are not perceived to be highly effective or adequate. Few reported using primary prevention to stop violence before it occurs. And informants lack shared knowledge of existing youth violence prevention resources that are available to their city. They also found that law enforcement and criminal justice are the most prevalent strategies that are used in the cities. Public health departments are not generally included in city strategies. Most cities lack a comprehensive strategy. But most importantly, cities with the greatest coordinated approach also have the lowest rates of youth violence. So some sample Unity accomplishments, we've been able to engage leading practitioners and scientists around the country, and they've helped us as we shape the initiative. We've helped to shape the approach that many cities are taking to preventing violence. Whereas in the past, when the discussion was about preventing violence, it was about more police on the street or more effective policing, which are things that may sometimes be needed. Now the discussion has broadened to what youth development opportunities are available for kids, you know, after school hours. So we've been able to help move that discussion. We've raised the profile of a public health-based approach to prevention. We've engaged multiple sectors in advancing a public health-based prevention approach to violence. And we've formed efforts to link safety and violence to healthy eating and active living. And this last one is also very important, because what people don't realize is the impact that violence has in a lot of our lives, especially in chronic disease. Like, we can make the link between diabetes and violence. If you have a community that is not safe, chances are parents are not going to allow their kids to go out and play outdoors just because, you know, fear of violence. But secondly, if you look at economic development, chances are that the retail choices research shows that the retail choices that are available in these communities are severely limited, so people don't have access to the foods that they need to be healthy. So these are some sample of the Unity accomplishments. The second thing we did is we developed the Unity roadmap. And basically what this is, that one lesson learned where I said it's not a program, it's not a particular program, what it really is strategies. Well, this is the basis for how to develop those strategies. We need the right people at the table, high-level leadership. We need good collaboration. You know, when we need communities to be engaged, communities to be setting the priorities. We need strategic plans that are built on community needs. We need strong data and evaluation, and obviously we need funding to help move this forward. And then the last thing is that we need to have programs, organizational practices, and policies. Even though earlier I said it's not a program approach, strategies can consist of multiple programs at different levels of, if you think of the domains, the public, the prevention domains. We also need increased communication between sectors and training and capacity building for being able to do this work. We released the Unity Policy Platform this is actually last year. And the Unity Policy Platform, this is when I talked about we know how to prevent violence, the Unity Policy Platform actually lays out what we need to do in the short term, in the medium term, and over the long term to prevent violence. And I'm hoping that I have those. I can't recite them off the top of my head. Well, in the short term, I can tell you that, you know, interruption strategies, violence interruption strategies are very important. And also school-based universal violence prevention programs, those can help in the very short term to help quell, like, immediate violence. And then over the medium and long terms, we're looking at more environmental factors, more environmental things like, you know, what type of parenting programs are in place? Are there opportunities for youth to become engaged? Are there safe pro-social activities that community members can be involved in? A number of the public health things that go into a healthy community are also the medium and long-term elements of preventing violence. One of our shining examples is Minneapolis, and Minneapolis underwent a process to develop a multi-sectoral approach, a public health approach to preventing violence. And as they went out and did all their research and came up with some goals, this is what they came up with. These are the four main goals, and everything they do connect to these four main goals. The first is to connect all youth to trusted adults, to intervene at the first sign of risk for violence, to restore youth who have gone down the wrong path, and to unlearn the culture of violence. And so sitting at the table, they have Parks and Rec, they have the YMCA, they have education, they have public health, they have a number of different sectors around the community that all come together, and they're working on these core goals. Everything they do works on these core goals. And this is you know, some of their outcomes. Juvenile justice rates of violence dropped over 40% in 2 years, the first 2 years. And the National League of Cities has recognized Minneapolis for their outstanding efforts. So one of the quotes from one of our Unity City Network members says that as cities, we need the flexibility to be able to respond to our own needs. We need to be fluid and dynamic and utilize our own understanding of our communities. And so again, this speaks to, you know, every city is different. You know, you have different people at the table. Some cities have strong mayors, some cities have weak mayors. And, you know, some cities like San Jose has a very strong community network of providers that work in the area of youth violence prevention. So, you know, depending on the infrastructure that exists, the way this looks will be different in each city. So we need to be able to meet cities where they are. Here we go. This is the one that I needed earlier. So the Unity Policy Platform, in addition to prescribing at the local level what needs to happen, also talks about the state and national supports that are needed. And so, you know, we need to allocate and align resources for preventing violence. We need a high-level focal point for preventing violence. We need the federal government and state governments to also engage in multi-sector collaboration to prevent violence at the local level, or to enable violence prevention at the local level. We need to equip people with the necessary skills to use this approach. We need to establish supportive data research and evaluation systems that recognize the public health approach to preventing violence. We need a more robust communications campaign about why the public health approach works. And we need to enhance the public health's capacity and infrastructure to participate in this arena. Natoya Walker, after a number of years of engaging in this approach, she said, "We know after years, decades of experiencing violence, looking at violence, what the outcomes and implications of violence are. But we also know that there are programs and processes and definitions that we need to put in place to decrease, to eliminate youth violence because it is preventable." Natoya is one of our very good partner. Natoya and the City of Cleveland are very good partners in Unity. And this is what I talked a little bit about earlier, that you know the interrelationship among violence and also the effect that violence has on other areas. And we have this report called Addressing the Intersection that actually talks, that example I gave earlier about the link between violence, community violence, and diabetes or heart disease. It goes into it much more deeply. But with that, we're gonna transition over to Dr. Howard Spivak, and we're gonna spend time at the end on questions and answers. So, Howard.
Good morning. I'm generally not into self-promotion, but I'm just gonna hang this here. Javier asked me to talk about some of the lessons learned from Unity and from the work that's been done in violence prevention over the last several decades. He touched on some of this when he first opened his talk, and I want to highlight several of those and maybe reframe them a little bit as well. Because I think that we not only have to understand and learn from what we've done, but we have to apply that knowledge and figure out how to address the barriers we've learned about as well as promote the successes that we've had. So, in that context, there are four basic areas I want to touch on. The first is that people do not understand why public health is even at the table with respect to violence prevention, and sadly, a lot of public health people don't understand why we're at the table around this issue. Now, we can bemoan that fact, or we can take it head on, and my preference is to take it head on, which means that we have to understand ourselves and be able to clearly explain to others why we're there. And there's a number of very explicit and clear reasons why we're there. Number one, we have data. We know how to collect data. We know how to analyze data. We know how to translate that data into usable information. And communities are desperate for this information, partly to try to figure out what to do, but also partly to make their case, for resources, to get the attention of the leadership in cities, and to get people on board. And not only do we have data, but we've used this data effectively to learn what programs work and, as importantly, what programs don't work, so that people, even with limited resources, can more effectively target where they put those resources and where they direct their energy. We also, from this data, know a lot about risk and increasingly about resiliency. And that's important because that's often the way we begin to try to frame our programs, so that especially in primary prevention, we want to create an environment and implement programs that influence that environment to promote strength of both individuals and the community itself, as well as reduce risk. The second thing that we bring to the table is that we really have a great deal of experience I'm going to move on. I've said enough about that. The second lesson that I want to focus on is that the process is as important as the product. If you don't do good process around developing programs, then you don't have a product. And what that means is that entering communities requires understanding those communities and understanding and knowing how to listen as well as talk. When you've seen one city, you've seen one city. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't apply programs to different cities, but they're going to look different, and more importantly, they're going to be developed in different ways. Different players are going to run them, different players are going to participate in them, and if we try to use cookie-cutter approaches, it isn't going to work, and we've tried that, and it doesn't work. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me over the years and said, we tried the Boston model and it didn't work. And the reason for that is that the impression was you could just take these programs, reproduce them in another city, and you'd have the same outcomes. Now, you can take programs and you can modify them into those communities, but you can't just plop them in there. And no program is going to work until a community owns the problem in the first place, which really does require a lot of process and a lot of listening and a lot of information sharing. The third lesson, which Javier talked to, but I want to go into in a bit into a bit more depth, is that no single program works. Now, the reason I want to talk about this is because you can't just say that. You have to help people to understand what that means. And there are two important pieces of this that I want to point out. The first is that when you say that, you have to say it with great care, because most people you're dealing with are associated with a single program. And if you challenge that by saying that you need to have multiple programs, it in some ways diminishes people's sense of what they're contributing to the solution. So on the one hand, we have to explain that it requires multiple programs. On the other hand, we have to value what individual people and individual programs are contributing to that. And this is a lesson that's been learned in Unity. This is a lesson that we learned in Boston when we spent over a decade creating a network of programs around the city. And when there was success, a few politicians came into the city and identified two or three programs that were the reason why we had our success. And what happened after that is a lot of people walked away from the table. If they're not considered part of the solution, why are they there in the first place? And in fact, what happened was that this network began to disintegrate. And a decade of work was diminished, and Boston is now redeveloping that very same model in a more sophisticated way, but there's a lot of work being done that really is just repeating what could have been maintained from earlier efforts. The second important element of explaining that one solution doesn't work, that it requires multiple efforts, is to frame it in the public health model. You know, public health approaches to health problems involve primary prevention and secondary prevention and tertiary prevention. No one program can do all of that. And if you do only one of those silos, you're not going to get very far because it's not a comprehensive approach to the problem. You've got to deal with the problem as it is in its immediate sense with secondary and tertiary prevention while you're introducing and implementing the efforts that focus on primary prevention. And again, I think we've learned over and over again that if you come in with a set agenda, if you come in and say, this is what you need to do, you need to focus only on primary prevention, you have no credibility at the table because you're not dealing with what a community considers to be immediate. But if you help deal with the immediate issues, your credibility to introduce and talk about primary prevention shoots through the roof. You know, I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago on the relationship between violence and nutrition and eating and weight-related issues. And a couple of people presented programs on the development of parks and its role in both violence prevention as well as physical activity. And one of these guys said, if you build a community of park, they'll listen to anything else you have to say. And I thought that was an incredible lesson. If you stop the gunshots in the middle of the night, then people are then in a position where they can start listening and accepting other elements of what has to happen. But if people hear gunshots all night, how are they possibly going to be able to hear some of the other messages? They're scared. And if you don't deal with their immediate fear, you're not going to get any place. The fourth lesson, which is in many ways for me the hardest, is that you have to have patience. This takes a long time. And if you enter thinking that you're going to fix something in a 3 or 5 year funding cycle, then you're setting yourself up for failure. Now, part of the problem is that funders, which I am now, I guess, don't necessarily apply that themselves. It really is hard, because what are we trying to do in violence prevention ultimately? We're trying to shift culture. We're trying to change norms in a community. We're trying to influence the values in a community that dramatically affect how people behave. That doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long time. It takes multiple messages. It takes persistence. You make 2 steps forward, you get 1 step back because something happens that, you know, stirs the pot in an unpredictable way. And if you look at public health successes in general, they don't generally happen overnight. They take often take a decade or 2 decades or sometimes even 3 decades. And that's true certainly today when many of the health problems we deal with involve social determinants and involve behavior and involve culture and environment in various ways. But it's even true if you look back at some of the public health efforts around infectious disease, for example. The fact that we create vaccinations and immunizations doesn't mean that we've solved or eradicated a problem overnight. It takes decades to both get communities to accept these interventions as well as spread these interventions wide enough that it really does begin to eradicate certain diseases within a community. Violence is no different. So we've learned a lot of lessons from our efforts in violence prevention. Many of them are lessons we learn over and over again in all of our public health efforts. And if we continue to try to better understand how the public health model applies to this work, it really helps us deal with the barriers that we face and helps us advance the work that we're doing. Thank you.
The interesting thing there, well, it was all interesting, but one of the things that really struck me there at the end was the time cycle for this change. And it seems like a lot of us seem to be planning on political life cycles or electoral life cycles, and a lot of this work transcends, it's much longer. So, you know, that's another challenge for us that want to advocate for this approach. You know, how do we transcend these political election cycles?